I wanted to ask you to speculate, if you will. If your father was offered the position of director of the Zoological Society today, in what directions do you think the society would evolve under his leadership?
Well, I think that's a very difficult question. As I see it, Dr. Harry was able to do what he did because of the times. Today, you couldn't begin to do what he did. The zoo is now a big business. It's become sophisticated. We have a $4.5 million a year advertising program. At the time Dr. Harry was president of the zoo, I doubt that there was any money in the budget whatsoever for advertising. Everything at that time was due to publicity in the paper. We had it. He had some excellent publicity in magazines like Time and Life, and that was what the zoo had as far as any advertising program. That's just one example. Another example of why it worked for him, let's say, was some of his techniques and raising money. He wanted to put up a cage, so he'd go down and he'd bum enough concrete to put in a foundation. And then he'd bring up somebody, let's say like John D. Spreckles. Not that it was John D. Spreckles, but let's say he did. He would take them all around through the zoo, show them what he was doing, what was going on, and then they would come by this place where this foundation was. And usually why he'd get somebody, whoever he was taking through, they'd say, "What is that?" And he'd say, "Well, that is going to be a new bird cage. But we ran out of money, and all we've got is a foundation." And this prospect would, in most cases, volunteer to put up the money to finish the cage. The cage had in many cases, they had no drawings. They had no city permits. They didn't have to go through a city permit. He could just go ahead and build as he saw fit. In fact, the zoo was exempt from having to get any building permits from the city. And it wasn't until just recently that we even got anything from the city. And now, of course, we have any major building has to be approved by the park board, and it has to be approved in the city. And you have all of these restrictions. But in those days, well, you didn't. And so as to which way he would go today with the zoo is kind of hard to answer. In one respect, I think he would probably side with Dr. Schroeder on a very high emphasis with respect to research. And of course, the other, and because research is going to be the answer to propagate endangered species. And at the time Dad started the zoo, the animal population in Africa was unlimited. So were animals in this country. And if some of them didn't survive, well, you went out and you got some more the next year, and you replaced your collection, and you kept it turning over. No longer can we do that. You have to breed whatever animal you're going to display. And I think he probably would have gone along with that idea that you reduce the number of species that you're going to show, but those that you keep, you're going to keep in larger numbers, and you're going to build on reproducing those animals and supplying them to other people that don't have any. And by the same token, other people are going to supply you with animals that they are capable of breeding. So It's a different game today than it was in those days, and in another way, another thing I think that is a real big difference in what's going on today and what was happening with building the zoo under Dr. Harry is that he had such a fantastic sense of humor and such a good rapport with people and everything that he really enjoyed what he was doing. And he had more funny stories to tell about the zoo and how he was working out some scheme to get something built or to get somebody really interested in it. And today it's all business. I mean, the people that are running the zoo today are pretty serious. I mean, they're doing their job, they're interested in their job, but they're not getting all the laughs and the fun out of doing it that he did. I don't know whether I make that clear or not, but he just got a big bang out of finagling somebody into doing something for him, or and to get something built, or to get the city to do something. He'd go down, you know, and maybe he'd want to get some money from the city or from somebody, so he'd go down and ask him for an outlandish amount of money. Cut him down to about a half, so he'd figure, well, I really only wanted a quarter of that. Yeah, and he'd get it. but today you just I'll give you another example of what the differences. We have had a big water, you know, water has gotten to be terribly expensive. And at one time we had a survey made and we had decided that we were going to drill a well down in the bottom of the canyon and see if we could get water, even if it was brackish. We could use it in our seal pools and down through Bear Canyon and we could keep the water changed so that the exhibits would look better. And we could have put a well down at that time for about $10,000. And Lori Klauber said, no, you're not going to drill a well down there. We don't want to drill a well. And so he killed it. And today, we were talking about it just recently, and I brought up the subject and I said, why don't we drill a well down there and see if we can't get some water? And the answer came back, we'd never get it by the EPA. You'd never be able to justify it. But then you could go ahead and without getting anybody's permission, you'd go hire a guy to drill a well and he'd go down and he'd drill it. And today you can't do those things. Different ball game.
So, in a few words, then I think what you're saying is that your father would have been, I think, happier. Where, in his time.
In his time, yeah. It was a natural for his time. Mm-hmm. Charlie Schroeder came along and he fitted in, and it was a natural for the way he took the thing over and brought it along. And one man fitted in at the beginning, the next man fitted in and carried it to a worldwide success. It took both men to do it.
Mm. Well, Mr. Wegerberg, thank you very much for your time. It's been delightful and informative, believe me.
I'm trying to think of anything else I ought to throw in here now that I thought of several things and then I forgot about them as we went along.
I can turn off the machine for it.
I don't know how many people realize it, but when Dr. Harry came to San Diego, he started in his practice here, and then he got his younger brother Paul to come out. And Paul had graduated from Johns Hopkins, number one in his class, and he was a very, very brilliant physician. And my dad and Paul used to sit on the office floor while they were trying to build up their practice, and they would sew sheets together, practicing with both hands. And Dad was ambidextrous. The two of them were the only two surgeons in Southern California that would do any brain surgery. There wasn't anybody in Los Angeles, but Dad and Paul were the only two that would do any brain work at that time. And Dad, as his name in Gray's Anatomy, as being the first man to invent an electric-driven saw to be able to trepan a piece out of a man's skull. And then he also invented a little wire clipping device to suture up a wound. So he was one of the finest surgeons in the community for many, many years. I don't know whether later on whether you might be interested, but I ran across an album here the other day that had the picture of the drill and the clipper that he invented.
I can see it.
Yeah. And then I guess also while I was thinking about it, I'm sure Dr. Schroeder probably told you about the turkey story about the turkey industry here in San Diego.
Yes, he did mention something about it, yes.
Okay. Well, it was through the research building, you know, that they saved the turkey industry here. And the turkey industry here was started by Dr. Harry and given a real big boost, because every year when he went back to Johns Hopkins, he would stop at the county fairs in the various states on his way back to California, and he would go in and he would buy the prize turkeys, the prize chickens, and let's see, and he brought and he had a whole selection of different kinds of pigeons, and we had my mother had a little 10-acre ranch out in Paradise Valley, and he put these things out there, and he had one turkey, Tom turkey, and this rascal weighed just under 50 pounds. And he had a hen turkey that weighed right up around 45. And the people, farmers came in from the turkey industry and they wanted to buy eggs from him. And he said, no, he didn't want to sell them any eggs. And they kept pestering him, and so finally he said, well, he said, if you want these eggs, he said, he had one group of eggs, he said, these eggs will cost you $50 a piece. And he sold them. And he had little wooden boxes made up, all felt lined, and with little sliding tops and everything on them, and he was selling eggs up for anywhere, I guess, from $10 to $50 a piece, depending on the turkey that they came from. And then the Depression came along in 1929, and it just wiped that business out. But the stock that he brought in founded the real turkey industry here in San Diego. And then, of course, when the turkeys became the eggs were infertile, then is when they got into the research problem up at the zoo, and they solved that problem, and the turkey industry flourished after that. and along with that, he had these little bantam chicks, and he found out that when the little tiny kids came into the zoo, they could care less about seeing a lion or a tiger or an elephant, you know, these little kids. But to chase a little bantam hen and its chicks around the zoo, oh, that was just great. So that's why the bantam hens are in the zoo.
So that's how it started.
Give these little kids something to do, and he brought in squirrels, and these little and guinea hens, and the peacocks, and they were all running around loose, and that's what the little kids liked, and that's why they are in the zoo.
That's why they're in the zoo. Yeah. That's interesting stuff.
And of course, in the early days too. We used to run around with the llamas, and then every once in a while, where they'd bring out a cheetah, we had some cheetahs there, and they'd bring them out on the leash so that people could see them up close and touch them. But I thought maybe you'd get a kick out of it.
That's
the turkeys.
I wanted to ask you something. I was just thinking as you were talking about the past and the present, and I was just thinking about. In a paper this morning, yesterday, about a keeper who was killed by an elephant, the wild animal at the Lion Country Safari. Were there any such accidents when you were on the board in your father's period?
Yeah, we lost a keeper with an elephant. We had a bull elephant at the zoo, and. And he finally got through and got the keeper, killed him. And of course, you know, we lost a keeper with a black panther a while back. And there's disagreement amongst some of the members on the board, but I remember one of the reptile men in the first reptile house. And we had all these cages with the lids lifted up on the top. And this guy would lift up the lid and take and put his arm down in and drop the rats down in there to feed the snakes. And Dad told him, don't do that. And the guy kept on doing it, and he got hit with a rattler. And they got him up to Mercy Hospital, and he died in a couple of days. There again, I mean, it's just stupidity on the part of the man that's playing around with rattlesnakes and not realizing or thinking that he's getting away with it, but he didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, with I was not too, well, I guess I was not in favor of our having bull elephants at the Wild Animal Park. For the reason that we lost a man down here, and talking with Dr. Schroeder the other night, he commented on the same thing. He says every time you got a bull elephant someplace, he says you got a dead keeper.
Mm-hmm.
Whether we're smart enough now or the facilities are good enough to prevent that, I don't know. But this is why the circuses don't want them. They're unpredictable. So we'll have to see, but of course we've got some nice young African elephants running around up there right now, and that makes a great show, and it's made a good story. But if the keepers can keep out of the way of this guy, everything will be great.
Yeah, he mentioned that in the interview I did with him a few weeks ago of the problems of the bulls, mm-hmm. bull elephants.
Yeah, they. In a musk, I guess it is, they call it, with it. You just don't handle them.
Mm-hmm.
We were up, just recently I was up there, and we were standing outside of the enclosure there for the bull African elephant, and boy, he sticks his old tufts and head up over there and his trunk out, and you can just see that look in his eye. Hey, I'd sure like to get at you guys.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want any part of him. Well,
thank you again.
Yeah,
very much.
I could sit around and give it and talk a little bit more, but we've got board meeting tonight.
Well, thank you again. I appreciate it.
Just one last little story was during Bill Benchley's time. We had the two big mountain gorillas, Babongo and Nagagi. And they were in the in these big wire cages that I'm pretty sure that the Scripps had given us these cages that I had mentioned before. But anyway, a fella came into Bell's office from Hollywood, and he said, "I want to make a little short," he said, "on the gorillas." So, and he said, "I'll have to get inside the railings in order to take my movie." So Bell said, "All right," and she wrote him out a note. He says, "You go down and see the keeper," and I can't think of the guy's name. I got it right on the tip of my tongue, but at any rate, this guy can't find the keeper. So he climbs in inside the fence and gets his camera, tripod and everything all set up, and he's got a nice lens, and it just fits in through the wire mesh. So he gets it in there, and he's busy cranking away and taking his movie of, I forgot whether it was Mbongo or Nagagi, but at any rate, he didn't know that the animal he was not photographing was coming around, and this gorilla just hated to be photographed. It just hated the noise of a movie camera. And Mbongo, let's say it's Mbongo, gets up there and grabs a hold of the lens of that camera, and just with a big jerk just pulls the lens right out of the camera, and pieces of the camera and everything come through the wire. And this guy left over, got outside of the fence in a real big hurry. But it just ruined his camera. But things like that, you know, things like that are always happening. And you just never knew what was, you know. Another time there, thinking of another story of a little sun bears that looked like they're real innocent. Mm-hmm. And we had them in a little small grotto up near the top of the Bear Canyon. Remember? And a sailor decided he was going to go in and play with them. And it was just lucky there was a keeper washing down one of the other bear grottos, and this guy got in there with these little bears, and they just started taking him apart real fast. And the keeper happened to have his hose going, and he turned the hose on the bears, and they got this guy out of there. But that's a sad mistake to jump in with those things. Okay.
Well, thank you again.